Trump Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for February 4th, 2018, the first Sunday of February, and yes, Super Bowl Sunday. Welcome to our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy. We'll take you to City Hall, to Springfield, and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So go grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a super start. Well, it's kind of a bittersweet day here at the Sunday Spin. It's a day of goodbye and congratulations to our own Sam Panayotovich, who's leaving the Windy City and WGN Radio to head to Las Vegas.
What?
Oh, you didn't get the memo?
No.
See, that's why everybody was saying...
He doesn't even know.
Everybody was saying, release the memo. That was the memo. Heading to Las Vegas, where you'll be a host for VSIN, the Vegas Stats and Information Network.
I was trying to hold on to that for a long time, and then once Feeder gets to it, you're screwed. I mean, you guys had an idea, because I've been going down there time and time again. I went in August and October.
I just thought you had a little habit, you know.
Not anymore. I kicked that one to the curb a long time ago. Yeah, it's a chance to work for Brent Musburger. That's pretty much...
Yeah, how cool is that?
It's pretty much what it came down to, an opportunity to be on the ground floor, have my own show, and challenge myself, I guess. It's been almost 2 years here on the mornings, and, you know, I said this yesterday with Lou and John. I'll say it with you and with Dean. You guys have been nothing but awesome to me. You've given me ample opportunities. I feel like I've added some youthful exuberance to our program.
Yes, indeed.
Sometimes, I would agree with that.
And the two adults in the grandstand with the Muppets. So it's all love, guys, and I really appreciate it.
Well, what are you actually going to be doing there?
I'll be hosting a show. It's sports for Vegas. So that's point spreads and odds and lines and why are lines a certain way and why are people betting on this team versus that team and how do these future wheels get made. And it's pretty much information, education, entertainment for sports betting, which eventually will be legalized nationwide.
So it's taking the data and giving some personality to it.
Correct. And also informing people along the way. We're not going to give our locks of the year or locks of the millennium. We're not touts. We're just trying to kind of carry the mail and bring this full circle, try and entertain and educate and inform the average person who doesn't know a lot about wagering on sports.
So you are going to get a significant size place in Vegas so that when Dave and I come out for the Blackhawks Golden Knights game, you'll be able to host us, right?
Let me get back to you on that. There will be a sectional. I don't know how big it is.
Okay. How about a room for we can pitch a tent?
How about... I'm not going to touch that one. How about two hammocks? I'll put two hammocks in the other room.
I'll bring my sleeping bag.
Okay.
Is that a deal?
Sure.
I'll find a hotel room. Okay.
I will have
a shortage of hotel rooms there. I think you'll be able to find something.
I will have a crock pot, though, for the green bean casserole.
All right. That's fair. That's fair. We can do that.
Oh, speaking... Well, if you're going to bring food, then we need the bacon blue cheese coleslaw.
Yes. You'll have to get a smoker, too, so we could do some pulled pork and, you know, just rub it up, right?
Sure.
Give you a taste of home.
It's only fitting, too, that I leave on the 10th. My first day is the 11th, and go figure, the Blackhawks play in Vegas on the 13th. I did not plan that.
And I won't be able to make that one.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's our first road trip
right
there.
No. Nothing before the primary, unfortunately. No road trips before the March 20th primary, but we'll definitely be there next season. And look, all of us around here are going to miss you on Sunday mornings as we commiserate over the various sports teams here. I know I'll miss our occasional conversations after the show at the Billy Goat, but I know who's going to miss you a lot more, and that's going to be your mom and dad. And
definitely,
they have to be. I'm proud of you, but there's nobody prouder of you than they are.
100%.
Well, congratulations. But before you leave, so who's winning the game tonight?
New England.
Is there any doubt?
I said 31-13 on the podcast.
So you're going with a larger point spread than what I've seen of only 6 points.
Right. Well, the spread right now is 4.5. It opened at 6. You're right, Schwani. See, yeah. This is why you need to listen to Visa, because we explain why it moved from 6 down to 4.5. There actually have been $7 million bets or more on the Eagles.
Really?
So all the big
bets. Trying to
bets,
take the long odds.
All the big bets in Vegas so far, and anything can change today, most of the big money is on the Eagles, so that's why it came down towards 4.5. But I still think it's Tom Brady in the Super Bowl with with a rookie, you know, rookie quarterback Nick Foles. A rookie by mean, when I say rookie quarterback, he's never been in the Super Bowl before. So, come on. I mean, sometimes it is that simple.
That's, well, everybody be watching that game tonight. Great news about Brian Urlacher going to first ballot Hall of Fame, and well-deserved, obviously. And, yeah, you said it all about, Sam, about the Hawks. I mean, just, I couldn't stay up for the end of the game last night. But here I kind of was starting to fall asleep, and they're up 2-0, and I'm thinking, okay, just play your game and it'll all be fine. And then I wake up this morning and find out that they lose 59 seconds into overtime.
They never trailed in regulation.
Yeah.
They never trailed. They didn't trail until the final shot.
This has really been a frustrating year. I mean, just the other night, I forget who they were playing, but I had a long week and I was working late, and it was a game that...
Vancouver.
Vancouver. And... I mean, they were skating well in the third period. I mean, they had the youthful legs going again, and I just don't know what it is. But they can get off to a great start, and then it just starts evolving and spinning downhill. And,
which we're just not used to.
No.
We're not used to seeing that.
And you know, time's running out. And this was the team Calgary was right ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could have picked up 2 points on them. There's, I think, 4 teams ahead of us to get to the playoffs. Very, you know, these are the games you got to win. And they had been doing so well on the road, too. I mean, obviously, given how the last game I went to at the United Center was that 4-0 Detroit loss that I wanted to leave early from. But they were doing so well on the road, and now it's just, you know, big changes are ahead.
For about 4 or 5 weeks now, and you've heard it too, and you've read about it, they've said the same thing after these games. Well, there's plenty of time. We have to go on a run.
Time is running out.
Don't know what you're talking about anymore. You don't have much time left.
You can go on a run, but the track isn't very long, okay?
30 games left. They probably need about 40 to 42 points. So they need points in...
every game.
Well, I don't know about every
no,
game.
No, I know which... But
they need a lot of points. They probably need about 95 points, and they have 56 now. So I think they need 40 points in 30 games, which means they've got to win...
20.
Right.
They got to win 20.
Pretty much.
I mean, loser points ain't going to get you there. That is not going to work.
Pretty much. You need 20 wins in your last 30. Yeah. And this team has not shown you that they can do that.
No. Not in a sustained way.
No.
At all. Well.
Sorry.
Thank you. There's a positive note to depart on, Sam. Thank you so much. And at least you will no longer have to hear Johnny Six Note at the Tree of Knowledge.
Mm.
That you take that with you to Vegas.
Okay.
I can send him some.
Could you take him with you?
Well, Swanee has videos on his phone now.
So he's learned that. Send him. He's learned that now. Wow, that's great.
And I wasn't even in his zone. I established my own zone.
You always have your own zone. I got to tell you that.
Let's not go there.
We're not. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam has the latest sports. Producer Cassera's here to field your phone calls. We're at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at Simple Sunday Spin. Engineer Bob is looking for the snow shovel this morning. As always, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead on this edition of the Sunday Spin, after we catch up on the news and sports at 7:30, we'll speak to Jason DeSanto. Jason is a senior lecturer at Northwestern's Law School, and he's always had an emphasis on kind of dissecting political speech, and we'll talk to him about President Trump's State of the Union address. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll move from the State of the Union over to the State of the State, and we'll talk to a very good friend of the show, WTTW Channel 11's Amanda Vinicky will join the program. We'll talk about the governor's State of the State speech, the race for governor, and this new and very controversial ad by Rauner's Republican challenger, Jeannie Ives. After a final check of the news at 8:30, we'll speak with State Representative Scott Drury of Highwood. The representative is fighting to stay on the Democratic ballot as a candidate for attorney general after an adverse ruling by a Cook County judge on Friday. That's all up ahead. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. To your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Time for our weekly spin through national politics and another crazy week in Washington, a week which began with the State of the Union address and which ended with Trump and congressional Republicans releasing a GOP-drafted memo claiming partisanship in the investigation of the Trump campaign, though what was released doesn't really show that. Instead, it shows the investigation didn't begin with the so-called Steele dossier. It began with that guy from Chicago, George Papadopoulos, who was bragging to an Australian, influential Australian official about contacts that he had. But let's go back to the beginning of the week. And here's a compilation of Trump's State of the Union highlights from Fox News.
We have created 2.4 million new jobs. Small business confidence is at an all-time high. The stock market has smashed one record after another. In April, this will be the last time you will ever file under the old and very broken system, and millions of Americans will have more take-home pay starting next month. We repealed the core of the disastrous Obamacare. The individual mandate is now gone. Austin's reverence for those who have served our nation reminds us of why we salute our flag, why we put our hands on our hearts for the Pledge of Allegiance, and why we proudly stand for the national anthem. The era of economic surrender is totally over. From now on, we expect trading relationships to be fair and, very importantly, reciprocal. Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to produce a bill that generates at least $1.5 trillion for the new infrastructure investment that our country so desperately needs. Tonight I am calling on Congress to finally close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminal gangs to break into our country. We have proposed new legislation that will fix our immigration laws and support our ICE and Border Patrol agents. I am extending an open hand to work with members of both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to protect our citizens of every background, color, religion, and creed, and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too. We know that weakness is the surest path to conflict, and unmatched power is the surest means to our true and great defense. For this reason, I am asking Congress to end the dangerous defense sequester and fully fund our great military. We must modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, hopefully never having to use it, but making it so strong and so powerful that it will deter any acts of aggression.
Those are some highlights from the president's State of the Union address. Then, of course, there's the memo. And the memo that was released by Republicans after Republicans chanting, release the memo. They control Congress. They control Washington. So they can release the memo. President tweeting out, this memo totally vindicates Trump in probe, but the Russian witch hunt goes on and on. There was no collusion and there was no obstruction, the word now used, because after 1 year of looking endlessly and finding nothing, collusion is dead, close parentheses. This is an American disgrace, Trump tweeted on Saturday. While the president says he's totally vindicated, the actual memo does not back up those claims. And in fact, undermines them. A lot of the attention being given to the fact that the FBI obtained a secret court order to monitor a former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page, and the memo alleges that the FBI didn't fully disclose to a special Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court that some of the information stemmed from intelligence reports provided by Christopher Steele, working under a contract with a research firm that was working on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Now, the FBI says that there was bias that was disclosed. They didn't specify necessarily that this was a Clinton memo or whatever, but the problem is the dossier, and looking at Carter Page, by the time the FBI was looking at Carter Page, he was no longer associated with the Trump campaign when that FISA court order was approved. So you have House Speaker Paul Ryan supporting the release of this memo, and here's what he had to say.
There may have been malfeasance at the FBI by certain individuals. So it is our job in conducting transparent oversight of the executive branch to get to the bottom of that. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so what we want is all of this information to come out so that transparency can reign supreme and accountability can occur.
So there is a lot more transparency that needs to occur here, because this is the Republican version of the memo. The FBI and Justice Department said the memo was incomplete, filled with misstatements, and drew erroneous conclusions. Trump says the memo exonerates him, but it really doesn't. Here's what the president said after he declassified it for public release, and he made ominous comments about the future of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein.
I think it's terrible. You want to know the truth? I think it's a disgrace. What's going on in this country, I think it's a disgrace. The memo was sent to Congress. It was declassified. Congress will do whatever they're going to do. But I think it's a disgrace what's happening in our country. And when you look at that and you see that and so many other things, what's going on, a lot of people should be ashamed of themselves and much worse than that. So I sent it over to Congress. They will do what they're going to do. Whatever they do is fine. It was declassified. And let's see what happens. But a lot of people should be ashamed. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You figure that one out.
You figure that one out, Rod Rosenstein. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. We're talking about the Republican memo and Virginia Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. He appeared on PBS NewsHour, and he said that the memo and Trump and his attacks on law enforcement and the justice community, he finds them to be very troubling.
People are willing to go out and basically impugn the very integrity of the whole FBI and, for that matter, the whole Department of Justice. And that gets us in very uncharted territory, but also, I think, very dangerous areas where basically the integrity of our law enforcement agencies are being called into question when it appears they're just doing their job.
That's Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my good friend, who I haven't seen for a while, Jason DeSanto. He's on the faculty at Northwestern's School of Law, where he's a senior lecturer. And maybe I say it wrong, but I always understood you to kind of specialize in speaking, political speech, words, and how words matter, or in this case, do they matter anymore?
Well, thanks, Rick. Yeah, I mean, I try to do a lot of work in the advocacy area and a lot of years as a speechwriter in politics as well, and I think words do matter. That clip you played there from Mark Warner, he's really talking about the president's propensity to run down anything that constrains his power. And one of the ways you do that is through language and questioning the rule of law, questioning judges, questioning the FBI, questioning those institutions. It was Jeb Bush who said that the president was the chaos candidate, and really it is a destabilizing factor. That is what he is about. When nothing is true, everything is true. Anything that constrains his power is to be destabilized. And he does that through language. And that's what, you know, it used to be at 140 characters at, yes, on Twitter. And now we've got, you know, 280. He makes good use of those as well. And the State of the Union was another example of that, though a bit different.
Well, I don't think it's wrong to necessarily question institutions. In fact, but this is obviously a, more than questioning, it's a discrediting effort to try to, in the end game, discredit whatever may come out as tainted or biased or whatever when Bob Mueller finishes his investigation.
Skepticism is great. That's what self-government is about, is the ability to question institutions because the institutions are supposed to work for us. But the president goes beyond that because he doesn't, if you notice, he questions those institutions when they seem to be getting in his way. Now, he's not the first president to have done that. I mean, Franklin Delano Roosevelt did that. He tried to pack the Supreme Court.
Right.
So presidents tend to bridle against power. He definitely does that. But to me, it's a pattern. And, of course, it's the press. It's law enforcement. It's the courts. Anything that tends to brush up against what he wants to do. And I think the irony of that is those are institutions that are supposed to aid self-government, well, not oppose self-government.
And even taking it further, those are institutions that Republicans have traditionally been the strongest supporters of, law enforcement and justice and those kinds of things. And so you find this president trying to parse his way about, oh, you know, I support law enforcement or whatever. At the same time, he's trying to take down one of the pillars of law enforcement.
Well, that's what destabilizing is about. And it's no small irony that there are probably plenty of liberals who have had problems with the way the FISA court operates.
Sure.
Largely in secret, I mean, totally in secret, and unless something gets leaked or, you know, Snowden came across something and was able to put things out into the public domain without representation of, you know, the people who are about to be surveilled. And yet, now it's Trump taking those positions as well. And that, I mean, that really does in some way speak to the notion of up is down is up. And that's fine if you are somebody who's trying to really muddy the waters. And that is a lot of what his work as a speaker and as a communicator is about.
But it's in a defensive posture.
I disagree with that.
Okay.
It's turning defense into offense. I mean, that is the posture. That's the old Roy Cohn postulate. His old mentor, who had worked with Joe McCarthy before that, was you're never on the defensive. You're always on the offensive, and that's the way language is to be deployed, among other weapons.
Well, let's talk about the State of the Union address. And, I mean, a lot of people watched, not as many as the president claimed.
Right.
Again. But, and generally got good marks in surveys done by the individual networks, including the ones he derides for spreading fake news, that the viewers generally gave it good marks. And I think part of that was, you know, goes back again to his previous speech before a joint session of Congress, which technically wasn't a State of the Union address, but it was composed and it was on the prompter.
Right.
And I think the prompter makes a big difference with this president.
The usual rule of thumb is when you hear a double adverb.
Okay. Example.
Totally. So totally. Very wonderful. Right.
Okay.
Some kind of adjective and an adverb. Then the president's gone off the prompter. Okay, at that point, when he's sort of adding
those things. Otherwise, he's on the prompter. And so the speech was relatively well received. In some ways, that's because, and this was the same when Bill Clinton was president, sometimes what the experts see as being a speech that doesn't work is something that actually does relatively well among the public. When Bill Clinton was president, people used to say all the time, those speeches are too long. They ran at over an hour. And yet, when they were actually polled in various sections in each of the proposals, they polled quite high. And it could be that the Trump speech, to those who are the analysts, is seen as, you know, it's just him and he's on the prompter. It may be within the public, it's perceived as, oh, he's marking a new course. He's acting the way a president should. And there was a Monmouth poll at the end of the week that shows his approval ratings have bounced back up to about 42%. How much of that is due to the speech is hard to say, but it is possible that he is being perceived in a positive way, partially because of the speech itself.
But even when you go back to that speech a year ago and you look at this speech, and people at times view this as some kind of a resetting of this presidency to be more presidential, but then invariably, as happened after the first speech, we're back into the same kind of game again.
Well, this is a lot about credibility. And way back centuries ago, when good old Aristotle was talking about persuasion, he talked about the way that people were persuaded, and one of those is through logic, through facts and reasoning, another is through emotion, through feelings and stories, and the last one is really the credibility of the speaker. And I take it that if you heard the speech on Tuesday night, it was all about credibility. The other thing sort of fell to the wayside because we're inclined, if you believe Trump, to enjoy what he's saying, and if you don't like Trump, to not enjoy what he's saying. Last year, the speech you mentioned, he gave that speech, and then a week later, he was tweeting out about having been wiretapped by President Obama. Right? So it seemed normal, and then a couple days later, it wasn't. This time around, we had the speech itself, and then the Nunes memo was going to come out a couple days after that. It's hard to take somebody at face value when they are talking about bipartisanship, when they have run a campaign impugning a whole series of ethnicities and races, when they have conducted themselves as president in the past year by saying that there are good people on both sides of a racial debate in Charlottesville.
Right.
So if you're inclined to remember those incidents, you don't think the president has much credibility on something like unity and seeming normalizing and stable. If, in fact, you think the president was on the right side in those debates, you think that that was more than credible. That's the cut of the man, and that's who he is. So, I mean, to some extent, the view is going to depend on the point of view.
And the preconceived notions that exist.
Yeah, and that's one of the challenges, I think, with any State of the Union. I think it was, to some extent, the same thing with somebody like Barack Obama, who had virulent enemies, and they were not going to take anything that he said at face value. I mean, that's why somebody could yell, "You lie," in the middle of a joint session on health care. And of course, Clinton as well, and probably to some extent Bush. But I think Trump creates those feelings at a deeper level and across the partisan divide. And so maybe 42% is the ceiling of people who would be inclined to see what he's saying as credible when it comes to the idea of unity.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto. He's a senior lecturer at Northwestern School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio and Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in studio is Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern School of Law. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address. We'll talk about State of the State in the next half hour with Amanda Vinicky. But we're talking about also words, how they're used, the power of words in these kinds of speeches. And given kind of the general public reaction that we talked about that from the network polls towards a positive, towards the speech, did Democrats make a mistake by sitting on their hands for the entire speech?
I don't think so. It seems like every year there's some great hue and cry about what the other side did and whether they sat and looked stone-faced and everything else. But that has become normalized.
I was going to say, that is the new normal.
And so, to me, that is not really a large-scale issue. To me, it's what the person who is at the microphone is saying and how they are appealing to people at home. Now, it can be said, it's always useful to appear like the reasonable person in the room. So if you're saying things that everybody ought to get behind and people are not clapping, that's going to make you look like the reasonable person. I think Barack Obama used that to great effect. But I didn't think that that was really what was going on the other night. Most of those issues where there was the sitting on the hands and where it was most clear were on things like immigration.
I was just going to bring that up.
And the immigration section of the speech was essentially the Trump inaugural extended into this speech. And what I mean by that, Rick, is the Trump inaugural was noted for talking about American carnage and
right.
the fact that America was a disaster. That was all done through language. That was a painting of a picture, a telling of a story that a lot of people don't really experience in their own lives, but a way to show this kind of dystopia. Most of this speech the other night did not do that, but the immigration section did. And it did through the painting of the picture of this criminal gang, MS-13. There were six mentions of MS-13. There were several stories. It was linked to terrorism, clumsily to opioid
right.
abuse. And then, of course, there was a rather dramatic story about a couple of teenage girls who had been killed by MS-13 as well. And all of that is done. And by the way, one mention of Russia, six mentions of MS-13. And all of that is done to create what I think is an extension from the inaugural, which is a vision of the world where citizens and the idea of citizenship isn't necessarily being bonded to one another, but rather is living in fear, and the kind of fear that this president can protect you from. And that is really, to me, what that section was about. And that led into the proposed compromise on immigration reform. That was the entry to the section, was that there was a great security problem that needed to be rooted out. That kind of language is not going to be the kind of thing that a lot of Democrats are going to get behind. That is just not a story that seems like an even-handed approach to what the nature of the immigration problem is. It is, like most effective rhetoric, a framing device. A way to understand the problem of immigration is through this criminal marauding band called MS-13. I think most people who look at the immigration issue would not say that is really what the immigration issue is fundamentally about. And so that's a rhetorical choice. And it's not a rhetorical choice that is really going to create common ground.
Well, rhetorical choice, trying to simplify it in basic terms on an issue that is, quite frankly, so complicated. That's part of the reason why we haven't had any kind of comprehensive immigration reform, though it's been talked about even from George W. Bush's days. And simplifying it in a way, using the rhetorical devices to paint it in the way you want it painted.
Yeah, and there's nothing about that that is strange for a politician, for an orator to do. It's what we do with language. The best stories are the ones that are the most vivid in the fewest number of words. What was interesting about that particular portion of the speech was pointing up into the gallery,
right,
having the parents of the two girls who had been killed there. And I think it was pointed out by James Fallows with The Atlantic that most of the time when presidents do that, when they point somebody out, and even in this speech too, most of the time it's to valorize somebody's
heroes. They're
people,
heroes.
People whose character embodies America and who we in this chamber need to follow. This was one of the first times that people were identified who were victims, that the people were there for us to see their victimhood. And I take it that that was done because the desire in that portion of the speech was to put us in the position of being victims. And this goes back to what I said before, which is, again, in most State of the Union addresses, most inaugural addresses, most farewell addresses, what presidents are doing is trying to reconstitute the citizenry. There's something ritualistic about these events. We all come together. We recognize the democracy. We share bonds with each other. And even the term, my fellow citizens, my fellow Americans, is designed to create those bonds. That's not what's going on in these portions of these Trump speeches. It is not a call for people to see what they share and can do together. What's happening in these situations is it's a call for citizens to see themselves as being surrounded and needing help. And the help needs to come from one person. And that's why you played a portion of the speech before the break where Trump was talking about who his oath was and what his duty was. It's very personalized.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the inaugural, it was my oath is to the American people and my duty is to the American people. And it's creating that one-to-one bond between the leader and those people who need protection. That is a very different thing. It's certainly not what Ronald Reagan did. It's certainly not what Bill Clinton or Barack Obama or George W. Bush did. And it is kind of this maximalist approach to power. Some might just say it's egocentric. But I think when you tie it to the idea of running down other institutions within government, it looks a little bit different than simply egocentric. It begins to look like somebody who believes that they should have all that power.
Where does persuasion fall into this, though? And because you have the kind of the speech that tries to influence people to feel that they're victims or to create the impression that they're victims. But when I think of persuasion in politics, I think of it normally in a larger kind of sense. It kind of like what you were saying about we're all in this together in a shared kind of mission to whatever in more kind of grandiose terms than like, I would say more blunt terms that Trump uses.
Yeah. Well, I think this is probably what becomes frustrating to Trump supporters because they hear a Trump speech and they hear things like the police and the flag and veterans and the national anthem and loyalty and Americans. And what they're hearing is these are all the things we rally around. These are the things that unite us. But what people who don't support Trump hear are those same words, but they understand them through the prism of all the other things, the victimhood, the fear, Colin Kaepernick, tweets about the national anthem, the Muslim ban. And so when they hear those words, they either hear them as hypocritical or they hear them with a shading, which means I know what that is. That's coded language. You're speaking to your supporters in one way and you're trying to win us over in a different way, but that's not what we're going to go for. And that really is the question of credibility. And so again, it becomes very difficult after a year, 2 years of kind of seeing somebody in the public arena to take those calls to unity and bipartisanship at face value because we're just not hearing them that way.
Because people have already, I mean, once again, it's the preconceived notion and it's their construction and through their own filter, that's how they, their own prism of how they see what is being said.
His credibility is being judged through the prism of carnage, right? We hear somebody who has described something as carnage. And when we hear that, it becomes more difficult to judge him as being credible. And he does all the other things that presidents do. He takes credit for things that may or may not have actually been things
stock
that he did.
Market,
right?
I mean, that's right.
I mean, that is what people do in these situations. Unlike somebody like Bill Clinton, who was doing that in the middle of his own perceived crisis, Clinton had about 5 years of presidency to point to where cause and effect could at least be more correlated in terms of economic development, right? And here,
sure.
Trump did what Clinton did. He just sort of ignored all the things about the controversy outside of the room. For Clinton, it was Lewinsky. For Trump, it's the Russia investigation. And you just sort of cite the indicators that are positive. But of course, if you are somebody who isn't a Trump fan, you're going to say, you've only been president for a year. I mean, everything you cite has been already in a positive way for the past 3 or 4 years. And so again, we're a little less inclined to believe the messenger because of things that have come before.
That's Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at Northwestern School of Law, an expert on words and how words are used. I always enjoy these conversations.
Me
very
too,
much.
Rick.
We'll do it again
okay.
Very soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to your second hour of the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower. Joining me in studio, a very good friend of the program, Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent for WTTW Channel 11 here in Chicago. Thank you for joining me.
But of course, good morning.
And it is a nice morning out.
It is gorgeous. I walked on over from the L, and I had the most pleasant walk. You know, you just felt a little bit of wind that brought along a couple of flurries. Nobody is out. You're all still in bed looking at the winter wonderland. But, yes, it's gorgeous. So, and listening to the Sunday Spin, what could make it better?
Thank you so much. Okay, yeah. I'll make it up to you later. Thank you.
Give her that 20.
Yeah, right. Sam, you know us too well here on the show, don't you? Wanted to shift gears from our conversation with Jason DeSanto on the State of the Union to the State of the State speech. But it was a busy week last week here in Illinois. We had the governor deliver his State of the State speech. But we also had the governor and his Republican primary opponent, State Representative Jeannie Ives, three-term Republican representative from Wheaton. They met for the first and likely the only time of the campaign before the Tribune's editorial board. And during this meeting, Rauner was asked about his controversial signature on a new law that expands taxpayer-subsidized abortions to poor women and women covered by state employee health insurance. That's basically the genesis of Jeannie Ives' challenge. This is the conversation at the Tribune editorial board.
To be crystal clear, I support a woman's right to decide.
What did you tell the Republican caucus?
That's my question. Politics are swirling around this, as I've said.
Well, what did you tell him?
He told us he would veto the bill.
I publicly said that that was being evaluated as an option. I publicly said it. It wasn't just to any caucus members.
That's right. Who lies to a cardinal?
That's outrageous. I publicly said that was being explored, and there was a lot of politics, a lot of pressure. In the end, I had to do what I believe is right, not do politics, and I signed that bill because I believe in a woman's right to decide.
What did you tell Cardinal Sipic you were going to do to the bill?
As I said to everyone, evaluating at a mandatory veto was something that we looked at. And in the end, it wasn't going to be about politics for me. It was going to be about doing what I believe was right, and that's what I did.
So you're right. This is a character issue. That's exactly what this election's about. It's about character, and it's about courage.
Yep, and I was courageous
about who has the courage to lead, who has the character for this job, who's going to stand up for the small person that's just beaten down by Illinois and its politics, who's not going to give in to crony bailouts of companies like Exelon, who's not going to give in to all sorts of new entitlement programs when the state is broke. So even if you believed that Illinois should pay for abortions, the fact that you did it when the state is bankrupt, an open-ended entitlement program in a state that is bankrupt, listen, it's pretty depressing to think that Planned Parenthood just opened a brand new clinic in Flossmoor in a community that's 80% minority, one-half in poverty, and just miles from the Indiana border. That's pretty depressing. You know why? There's zero accountability in our Medicaid program. There's zero. I'm sure we'll be paying for girls from Indiana that come over and get Medicaid abortions in the state of Illinois. And we have no money for this brand new entitlement program. And for him, as a Republican, because this is a Republican primary discussion, for him as a Republican to violate the Henry Hyde Amendment, the truce that's been in place for decades after the Roe v. Wade decision, the truce that said, fine, abortion's legal, but I shouldn't have to pay for it if I'm a taxpayer. He violated a strong tenet of our party, and then he lied about what he was going to do about it. That's why he's got very, very few endorsements on his side, and I've got more endorsements of my colleagues, and many are sitting on the fence. That's why not a single Republican in the congressional delegation has come out to endorse this sitting governor, because nobody trusts him and nobody agrees with his policies. He sure did implement an agenda. It happened to be his wife's agenda, socially progressive agenda from his wife.
Do you want to
in
respond?
A state that is broke.
This is more false, vicious attacks.
It's not false. It's not vicious. I said it nicely. It's the truth.
And Madigan loves everything that you're saying, everything that you're doing. Social issues are divisive. We need to be united.
And you're the one who promised no social agenda.
So, yes, that was an extended cut, but I thought it was important here. And so you come off this forum of these two, which it was very evident that it didn't appear Bruce Rauner wanted to be there, number one.
Of course not. Hence, it's the only,
right,
quote, debate between the two that is scheduled.
She gave a good performance, and that started last week. And we end the week with a new TV ad, a very in-your-face TV ad featuring an actor representing a transgendered woman saying, thank you, Bruce Rauner, for letting me use the girls' bathroom. We have a woman dressed kind of as a woman's rights protester saying, thank you for paying for my abortions, plural. And the only person of color in the ad being a woman portraying a Chicago teacher saying, thank you for bailing out our pensions.
Also someone thinking, of course, mockingly,
oh,
Governor,
and then the
for making Illinois a sanctuary state, and he's oddly wearing a bandana across his face, the man who's doing this,
right,
quote, thinking.
So I would argue that given Jeannie Ives' history in the General Assembly, you've seen her there.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That ad probably is more representative of her views than what she did in the Tribune's editorial board.
You know, this ad, of course, has gotten a lot of attention from, there are very much people who are backing the Ives campaign that say, yes, thank you, preach. This is exactly what I've been thinking and feeling. And then you have a lot of backlash, including from some leading Republicans, including the other constitutional office candidates, so for and the head of the Republican Party,
which are
Tim Schneider,
with,
who are aligned with Bruce Rauner, although right. Rauner himself not very specifically denouncing this, including last night when he was at an Equality Illinois gala. I was not there, but from the reporting, it apparently didn't say anything about this ad. But this is certainly something that, in terms of, as you heard Representative Ives there say, that this is a contest of character. A lot of people saying that is the opposite of the character that we believe should be an elected official in the state of Illinois or a candidate, and calling for that ad to come down because they find it repugnant and racist. The Ives campaign saying that this is a true representation of what Rauner did and Republicans need to know, and this is a Republican primary, and these are issues that they say many members of the GOP may be unaware of, and well, they sure as heck may be now. If you've seen that ad, it certainly is one that does not escape your memory very quickly.
Even though, as they say, it's a true representation of, it's not.
No.
And claims that they make in the ad are exaggerated or
right.
misstated.
Right.
So I just...
Exactly. Thank you. Yes.
Just for the record, that's what they say, but on a factual basis,
right.
they're exaggerated and misstated. We're speaking with Amanda Winicky, political correspondent with WTTW Channel 11. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Showcase studio by Amanda Winicky, political correspondent for WTTW Channel 11. We're talking Republican politics in the Republican governor's race, and most recently this new Jeannie Ives ad. And, I mean, obviously this is her campaign. They just got a $500,000 cash infusion from Richard Uihlein, arch conservative, former Rauner supporter, Uihlein, who also recently basically solely funded a super PAC to try to help Roy Moore overcome the sexual harassment claims, and ultimately was defeated in that special election in Alabama. So now you got Uihlein throws in $500,000.
And well, I think the key question is, will there be more, and if so, how much? Rauner's first campaign, he gave something like $2.6 million, I think, along those lines. And, of course, Rauner very much able to finance his own campaign, so didn't need that Uihlein money as much as Ives does. If she wants to, for example, continue airing this ad or another introduction
right.
sort of
and
bio
I,
ad that she's running. In general, she needs money, although she's certainly getting a lot of free media, whether it's good or not, from this ad.
Right, but I think part of this is to try to move the dial.
Totally.
And then there might be more money to follow. But at the same time, and granted, yes, it's a Republican primary. You're trying to appeal to Republican voters. But at the same time, when you throw an ad like that out there, there's always the issue of how do you run politics? And is it a growth, you know, do you try to grow your support? Do you try to grow an audience? Or do you take the ostensive support that you have and just try to stir a fire under them to make sure that they turn out? I think that, to me, is a fundamental question in this ad.
And, of course, you have to take it. Sure, let's say that this wins Jeannie Ives the primary. There's been no indication of polling that she is near that point, but this certainly will boost her with people that weren't aware that they had somebody in the Republican primary that represented their views and are very angry at the governor, be it for these social issues or for just in general how the state has gone during his tenure, promises of an improved economy and all the other promises that he made as a candidate that didn't really come to fruition, in part when you had these years-long budget impasse. But yeah, you gotta win a general election. So, I think that many of the more moderate Republicans or pundits will say, hey, what Rauner said right there during the clip that you played at the beginning of the hour in terms of Mike Madigan is loving every second of this is most definitely true. Any Democrat is going to be absolutely smiling that this has become an issue. Any sort of further splintering of the GOP, which is already at this point clearly very divided.
I just want to get there because I think there could be very devastating consequences for the Republican Party moving ahead. You've seen from the governor's disastrous summer with the shakeup in staff resulting in another shakeup of staff, the fracturing there that occurred between alliances that he had. Those alliances have disappeared. The people who are behind Jeannie Ives now, who were in the Rauner camp, got money from Bruce Rauner, and now are running her against him. I think there are some very serious consequences that could be in play.
You know, Rick, I think that that is something that has, it's sort of escaped the headlines right now because we're focused, obviously, on an election. There is something very material to report on that will have a difference, make a difference in people's lives.
There's the day-by-day stuff.
And yet, what it has escaped notice is that Rauner, you had these divisions in the Illinois Republican Party and Republicans elsewhere.
For a long time.
For a long time, they'd festered. And Rauner was able to bring everybody together. When he won, yeah, sure, there was a divided Republican primary that he ultimately won, became governor, and you saw sort of, it was an opportunity for the Illinois Republican Party. Once again, and part of that, it was because of the governor's money.
A
lot of legislators were, frankly, I would say scared, frightened of him, and closed ranks because, oh, wow, he's going to run somebody against me, and he's got the money to do it, and we've seen his success. It was a very tightly run ship, and that's where you look at all that has happened, be it the distrust that you could hear in Ives' voice in terms of what happened with the abortion bill. There's that. I think when we say staff shakeup, it was so much more than just, okay, so there's a firing here, a firing there. It was, this is a bruising battle, and both sides have kind of wounded soldiers along those grounds and are girding their loins on each side going forward, and what this means for the future of the Republican Party, particularly as you look at some of the legislative races now as well. There are so many primaries, and Rauner is no longer able to be the guy that is protecting those who stuck with him as well, because he isn't as popular. And again, questions in terms of, clearly Dick Uihlein is funding a lot of the opponents. And something that's interesting is you have Uihlein that is paying really for Liberty Principles PAC, which is funding a lot of campaigns for any of the Republican legislators who are still running for re-election who voted for the tax increase, as well as, of course, the primary against House GOP leader Jim Durkin, who is an ally of Rauner. And yet Rauner himself saying, I didn't want the tax increase. And for a time, it was thought he was going to be the one that would run an opponent against anybody who had voted for that income tax increase and had betrayed him and his request. So it's really a mess all over the place in the Illinois GOP. And you saw that even it was difficult, it seemed, to even get a statewide slate. You have a sitting Republican governor, and there's not a lot of attention other than Attorney General candidate Erica Harold for the other constitutional offices. That's pretty incredible.
Well,
shouldn't go unnoticed.
Look at the State of the State speech, and the reaction was very muted on the Republican side for the most part. And both at the Tribune editorial board and during this speech, I just detected a noticeable, I would say, lack of energy in the governor in his remarks. And not that he was necessarily
he's
just
never
going
been a
through
showman
the,
that Trump is
no,
or anything.
No, no, but certainly when you go back to his I actually reviewed a debate appearance that he made in October of 2014 against Pat Quinn, and very confident, you know, just had had a lot more energy.
Mm-hmm.
And just this is kind of like a guy who's been, you know, pretty much hit on all sides. And in that speech, obviously, not a lot to show for those first 3 years.
No, not certainly not. You know, and as you said, he has. And truth be told, so for example, the abortion bill, HB 40, one could say that it was very much designed to do just what it has done in terms of the fracturing of the Republican Party. Let's be clear. Democrats had control of the Illinois General Assembly for some time before Bruce Rauner
became governor.
They had the governor's office. They had super majorities in the House and in the Illinois Senate. Could have easily passed something that expanded taxpayer-funded abortions to individual low-income individuals on Medicaid and to state employees who, of course, have Illinois' health insurance plan, and didn't do it. That was brought up now at this time in year ahead of an election. And again, there's another element of this, and that is that it would change what happens if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade in Illinois. And so there is this sort of Trump reaction to it. It is a time where we've seen the Women's March bring record numbers of people to the streets in Chicago and across the country for these marches. And yet one could say that, wow, yeah, Democrats planned it this year and they succeeded because Rauner is presumably not going to get a ton of votes from maybe in moderate Democrats who are very upset at what else has gone on during his term. And of course, angered now the Republican conservative ranks. And he's truly in a pickle with this, quote, social agenda, where there are those who say he's not our guy. He hasn't gone far enough. Sure, he went to the Equality Illinois Gala and has given money to LGBT causes. But I just looked this up as well, the press release from but he's given money to candidates who are anti-LGBTQ rights. And at the very same time, again, those conservatives who are so angry that he has, quote, betrayed them over the HB 40 signings, he could not win.
There's so much ahead in these next few weeks leading up to March 20. Amanda Vinicky, political correspondent at WTTW Channel 11. Thank you, as always, for joining me.
It is my pleasure, as always. Stay warm, everyone.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Showcase studio. Joining me now is State Representative Scott Drury, a Democrat from Highwood. He's also a Democratic candidate for Attorney General, although there was a little wrench thrown into that on Friday when a Cook County judge ruled a deficiency in your filing, not because of lack of signatures, but a question on paperwork. You intend to appeal that.
Absolutely, and good morning. The matter is already on appeal, and I'm confident that we will be on the ballot come March. The fact is that when you're doing very well and you run a reform campaign, there are a lot of people who want to try to get you off the ballot, and we take that as a sign of strength.
So let's kind of say, who is Scott Drury? I mean, there are some notable things, and we'll talk about those, but who are you? And you were briefly a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor when Lisa Madigan decided not to seek re-election.
Right. So I'm an attorney. I've been practicing for about 20 years now. Grew up in the northern suburbs of Chicago. Spent most of my legal career at the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago, all under Pat Fitzgerald, where I was working on public corruption cases. I did a major civil rights case against a police officer who beat up a helpless victim who was handcuffed in a wheelchair. And after about 7.5 years there, I thought maybe I could do more public service and clean up the state of Illinois from the inside. So I ran for state representative, and for the last 5 years, I've been probably the chief advocate for ethical and just ethics reform in the state of Illinois.
Now, of course, being as a Democrat, you've had your run-ins with Speaker Madigan.
Yep.
You did not vote for him. You were the only Democratic legislator did not vote for him for Speaker. And that's kind of become a hallmark for your tenure in the legislature.
Well, and it kind of was a buildup. The beginning of my third term, I did not vote for him for Speaker. And over the two previous terms, I saw things in the House. I've had conversations with him that made me realize he doesn't speak for me. And I don't think he should be speaking for anybody in the state of Illinois. The state, everyone, when you talk to them, oh, Illinois is corrupt and it's going in the wrong direction. It's much worse than people think. And the conversations that I've had, the things that I've seen over the last 5 years, really have spawned this race. We need an attorney general who is going to be independent of politics. It's a shame that this is an elected office, a partisan office, because that creates doubt in the minds of the public. Is the attorney general really on my side? And I can tell you, and the public should know, given the stances that I've taken against my own party to my own political detriment, that I'm doing this because I want to see the state move in the right direction for the first time in my lifetime.
So when you say about conversations that you've had, what are you talking about?
So leading up to the last election, it was in October, the Speaker and I hadn't spoken in months. There was another vote that I didn't go along with him regarding taking away the union's right to strike, and I just thought that was the wrong thing to do. So I was trying to pass for years legislation to protect children, to protect their data when it's used in school. They get these iPads, they get these Chromebooks, and then I had legislation for years I was trying to move. Apple was against it, Facebook was against it. And finally I was speaking with his general counsel, the Speaker's general counsel, and said, hey, I'd like this to move again. Within a minute or 2 minutes of that phone call, I get a call from the Speaker, hey, we should go to dinner. So we go to dinner at the Union League Club here in Chicago, and all of a sudden there's just this shady juxtaposition of campaign contributions and my legislation. And at that time, you know, the Speaker was concerned about Donald Trump. He was starting up a super PAC that was head by a senator, a state senator that was raising tons of money, and he hit me up for like $60,000 or $70,000, and we hadn't, like I said, we hadn't spoken in ages. And at the same time, we're talking about this legislation that the only purpose was to protect kids. And so I made no commitments during that conversation, but the whole thing made me feel just so gross.
You're talking about the Lyft pack that Senator Biss was running?
Yeah. And I'd said to him, like, look, I don't take money from you. I don't take money from the party. I'm not going to give you $60,000 or $70,000. And he said, don't worry about it. We have another way to do this. And he gave me a flyer that described Lyft pack. And, you know, you could do it that way. It's like, I'm not going to be part of that. That's not how I function. And so came home that night and said, I've done nothing wrong, but just being in that conversation makes me feel so gross. And the next day I called up the speaker and I said to him, I just want to make sure in no uncertain terms that there's no agreement between you and me for anything. I don't work that way. And he said, Scott, I don't work that way either. And I said, okay. And that was the last time we spoke until there became rumors that I might run for speaker. And then he called me again and said, you know, we should talk again. Are you going to run for speaker? So this time we met at his law office in Chicago on LaSalle Street, just me and him. And, you know, he was showing me stuff. Are you going to run for speaker? Is Jim Durkin going to nominate you to be speaker? But the weirdest thing about that conversation was that at the very beginning, he gets up really close to me, like talking to my chest almost. And he says, I just want to make sure we're clear on one thing. You had made that phone call to me a few months ago. I don't do that. I don't sell legislation. And I've had enough experience as a federal investigator working on police corruption and seeing how people talk when they think someone's wearing a wire. And there was no question in my mind that comment was made because he thought I might be working with the federal government. And it was kind of amazing to me. I walked out of that meeting and I was just like, there's absolutely no relationship here. I could never vote for him to be speaker again. And we need wholesale change in this state because this is just a mess.
We're speaking with Scott Drury, Democratic State Representative from Highwood, also a candidate for Attorney General in the Democratic nomination. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune. Joining me here is State Representative Scott Drury, a Democrat from Highwood and a Democratic candidate for Attorney General. What do you see as your agenda? Is it the corruption agenda as your themes for being Attorney General?
Sure. My theme is I'm running for Attorney General to clean up Illinois, and certainly a major part of that is dealing with the endemic corruption in our state. For too long, the state has outsourced public corruption investigations to the federal government, to Tribune investigative reporters, to the Better Government Association. We should be doing that in-house. And, you know, we need an attorney general that the public knows is independent, that the public knows has experience investigating and in convicting people of public corruption. And that's what I bring to the office. Now, certainly, part of cleaning up Illinois, we need to deal with the gun violence epidemic and the opioid epidemics, and that's a big part of why I'm running as well. Again, I have experience on the federal side. I worked in the federal program Project Safe Neighborhoods, which was a proven success in reducing gun violence in the early part of this century. And, you know, I know that it takes a comprehensive approach. It's not just about sentencing. We need to invest in communities and look at the societal issues that cause gun violence. So when you look at the state, it's just I don't see enough will on the part of politicians to fix the real problems that the state has, and that's why I'm running, and those are the issues that I'm going to tackle starting on day one.
When there have been campaigns for attorney general in the past, people always bring up the I'm going to go after corruption. There's the issue of the limitations of the office as far as, you know, some people proposing that the attorney general have the right to engage in statewide grand juries to directly refer prosecutions, directly prosecute rather than refer. The argument now being that they have to refer prosecutions to local prosecutors, county prosecutors. A lot of reluctance to that because it's turf war and political agendas with that as well. But there's nothing that necessarily stops the Attorney General from conducting investigations.
Well, and I actually do not subscribe to the theory that the Attorney General doesn't have the power to open up statewide grand juries. There's been a lot of talk about that, and the current Attorney General says that she can't do that. But when you look at the actual Constitution, it's very vague about what the Attorney General's powers are. It just says, well, shall have the powers granted to it at law. And going back historically, what that meant is at law was at common law. And when you look back in history, that granted the Attorney General broad grand jury investigative powers. And so I believe that under the current Constitution, these investigations can be open. And in fact, when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office back in 2003 is when I started, Lisa Madigan was actively investigating Governor Blagojevich's administration for corruption. Now, that stopped, but she was doing it. And, you know, I have the experience to lead these investigations, to direct these investigations, and I'm confident that we will be able to recruit some of the best prosecutors in the state of Illinois to come over to the Attorney General's office and work on these cases and turn this office into one that's on par with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago.
What is the cooperation like between the Illinois Attorney General's office and the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I can't completely speak to that. I know that when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, there was this letter written by then U.S. Attorney Pat Fitzgerald to Lisa Madigan saying, hey, you're investigating, we're investigating, let's work this out amongst us.
Well, I mean, should there be more,
yeah,
more of a relationship in those?
I think there should, and I can, you know, I can be that bridge because I still have a lot of contacts. John Lausch, he was a colleague of mine when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I don't subscribe to these turf wars, whether it's between state's attorneys and attorneys general, whether it's between the U.S. attorney and the attorney general. Everybody has the same common goal, which is to do justice. And if one investigation is further along than the other, then someone should help out with it. If one agency has better resources to work on an investigation, then the other people should help out on it. You know, my goal is to make the state a state that people can trust. And I know that there is more than enough to go around for the AG's office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the state's attorney's offices to investigate all of this and still have plenty to do.
A lot of talk in this campaign among candidates about attorney generals being kind of a role to go up against moves by President Trump and the Trump administration involving areas on from environment to immigration, whatever. Where is the balance between that kind of role as versus what the citizens of Illinois and the common kind of protections that are supposed to be afforded by the Attorney General's office?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. If an executive order comes out of the White House that infringes on the constitutional rights of citizens here in Illinois or residents of Illinois, then it's incumbent upon the Attorney General in Illinois to protect those citizens, to stand up for the laws that we have here in our state. And so a lot of these lawsuits haven't really been filed by the Attorney General in Illinois, but she's joined in them.
Right.
I think that's absolutely the right thing to do. In present times, the attorneys general across the country are the only roadblocks to bad policy coming out of the White House, because Congress certainly isn't going to stop it. I think that, you know, that would exist regardless of who the president is. The attorney general needs to represent the people in this state. And so that would be, you know, part of my agenda. And I have experience, you know, litigating in federal court. That's where I practiced exclusively when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And that's something that I bring to this office that a lot of the others don't, is that I've been a practicing attorney the entire time. I'm a member of the federal trial bar here in Chicago. I teach trial advocacy at Northwestern's Law School. So I'm not running to be a figurehead. I'm running to be a hands-on attorney general who is going to, you know, give a pulse to this office that's going to make it on par, like I said, with the U.S. attorney's offices here in the state, and on par with the New York attorney general office, which everyone's always talking about what Eric Schneiderman's doing out in New York. Well, they should be talking about what we're doing here in Chicago and here in Illinois. And that's what I'm going to do with the office once I'm the attorney general.
Aside from the issue of corruption, which I'm kind of expecting you would say, but when you look at Lisa Madigan's tenure as attorney general of the state, is there an area that you might have highlighted or she's been deficient on differently?
Well, first, I think she should get accolades where they're due, and I think she's done a very good job on the consumer protection side. And I certainly would want to see the office continue doing that. Where I think, besides corruption, where the office possibly could have done more is just using the office's platform, to talk about bigger issues in the state of Illinois, like gun violence. The Attorney General isn't going to pass legislation, but certainly could be advocating for the solution to the problem and be on the front lines of, you know, is increased mandatory minimum sentences, is that going to solve the problem, or does it take more? And it certainly takes more. And like I said, the Attorney General is a position that I think people in the state of Illinois, they want to trust that person. So if the Attorney General speaks out and says, this is the solution to gun violence, or at least part of the solution, we need to invest in our schools, we need to have after-school programs, we need to have major criminal justice reform, that's going to resonate with the people in the state, and it's going to resonate with members of the General Assembly, and that's how we're going to get the change. So I want to use the office as a platform for advocacy to move tough issues, not just easy ones that are popular, but issues that may be controversial but are necessary.
So more of a bully pulpit.
Whether it's a bully pulpit or it's just an educational pulpit or both, it certainly needs to be used in that way. People should be able to look to that office and say, what's the answer? And they should be able to trust what that answer is and trust that answer isn't political, that it's the answer that's just the right thing for everyone, Republican, Democrat, or Independent, for everyone in the state of Illinois.
Representative Drury, your website is?
ScottDrury.org.
And we will stay tuned as the appeal takes place.
Thank you. I appreciate the time this morning.
That's Representative Scott Drury, a Democrat from Highwood, Democratic candidate for Attorney General. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.